Happy May 4th to you. I learned this morning before church, someone told me that today is Star Wars Day. Do you know that? Annual Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. It's a bad joke. It is a bad joke. Hey, everybody should have this morning, I hope, a rock that looks something like this. And hopefully over this series, we've talked about life and we've kind of focused on the big what if. We've talked about different realities. What if life could become death? That first week we talked about, man, these are things that bring death into my life. Things like worry and fear and anxiety. And we talked about depression, certain things about our jobs sometimes that we feel like bring death. And then last week we talked about, what if I could have my marriage back? What if I could have the relationship that I always dreamed of? And we talked about things in that message like temptation. And some of us are in relationships that we ought not be in as single people. So some of those things need to end, and some of the patterns of anger or addiction in terms of how we relate to each other. So I hope God's been speaking to you, and I hope that you have written something on your rock, or maybe God will reveal something to you this morning, and you can put that on your rock. So again, we've got rocks coming around, Sharpies if you need them. We're going to take those rocks, and we're going to fix those, take this piece of art up here, and kind of put those two things together. And somewhere we're going to hang that around the church just as a reminder to us of how God brings life out of death. So this morning we're talking mainly about joy. What if I could have real lasting joy? And when we talk about joy, we're talking about this unique ability, the capacity to express what will be in what is. That's what we mean whenever we say joy. Joy is being able to see a bigger picture, a longer term eternal view in the face of current adversity. Now, Jesus had a lot to say about joy, but he kind of made a unique statement in John chapter 16, and I'll read to you verses 21 and 22. He says this, "A woman giving birth to a child has pain because her time has come. But when the baby is born, she forgets the anguish because of the joy that a child is born into the world. So with you. Now is your time of grief. But I will see you again, and you will rejoice, and no one will take away your joy." So Jesus says simultaneously, there's grief, but at the same time, there's joy. There's this consistent underlying reality that the disciples could have. They could see God's bigger picture at work. And the metaphor that Jesus chooses to talk about that in joy is he talks about childbirth. Now, if you've been blessed to have a child, you kind of been through that process. Whenever Angie and I were pregnant with Sydney, our oldest child, the hospital strongly encouraged us to pay for these birthing classes called Lamaze. Lamaze is the French word for suckers, right? Because we show up at these birthing classes, and I can remember two things. They taught me two things. First thing right out of the gate, they told me about my role in the process. They said, "You are the coach." Hey, I'm good with that, right? Because the coach is the guy in charge. I like that. Except they said, "You're not that kind of coach." I was to be the breathing coach. That was my job, one of my roles. Of course, I thought, breathing coach? She's been breathing all of her life without a coach. Why all of a sudden is she going to need a breathing coach? And this is the second thing they taught me, is the reason she's going to need a breathing coach is because during the process of labor, she was going to experience some, not pain, because that's a Debbie Downer word. They didn't use the word pain. Instead, they used the word discomfort. Yeah, see, some of y'all been to Lamaze. She was going to experience some discomfort during the process. So whenever it was time to have Sydney, we went to the hospital. And sure enough, the teachers in the Lamaze class were right about one thing. We had some discomfort in that process. Because our doctor had two ladies who were kind of, it was kind of like NASCAR. They were giving birth about the same time, going through the process. Well, somewhere along the way, that other gal, she progressed a little bit faster than we did. And so because of that, she kind of took some of the attention. Well, when she did, we started to progress a little further, and it became time for the all-wonderful drugs that we needed. And there was a delay in getting us the drugs that we needed because all the focus was over here on this other lady. And I tell you, I needed those drugs, right? Listen, I've been over Angie's bed, rubbed her back for what seemed like hours. I barely ate, but I never complained. I was exhausted, right, in this process. And so we're going, and there's, I mean, in that moment, there's nothing you can do. We've asked for the drugs. The drugs, they're not coming. So Angie, love her heart, she's laying there in the bed. That time was laying on her side and looking her right in the face is this monitor. And this monitor would tell her how strong the contractions are. So they look like little mountains, you know, that would come up. And so the little hills, and then all of a sudden they go like this. And then all of a sudden, they start really, really going up, right? And what am I supposed to do? I was a perfect Lamaze coach, right? Honey, are you experiencing discomfort? Remember to breathe, right? In the process. And Jesus says, that's what joy is like. Because, you know, after we had the baby, after we had Sydney and they put her in Angie's arms and we were standing there, I don't remember us ever talking about labor. Because Jesus says that the joy having a child, a new birth, outweighs the discomfort of labor. That's what joy is like. It's this consistent ability to see the bigger picture in the face of adversity. Now, we're going to look today at a book in the New Testament written by the Apostle Paul about joy in particular. He wrote to the Philippian church. And if you're here today and you're not a Christian, or you would, you probably wouldn't say it out loud here, but you would say, Christians really annoy me. You are going to love Paul, because Paul, same kind of way. All the things that you dream about doing or you wish you could do to Christians who annoy you, Paul did them all. Paul persecuted Christians. He was mean to Christians. He actually even murdered and killed Christians. But then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he became one. And I believe he became one in part because of the joy that he saw as he persecuted Christians, that they had in seeing the bigger picture. Paul saw something different in them that made him take a look at his own heart. So we're going to look at Philippians chapter 1. We'll start reading in verse 12. Paul says, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Part of our role as Christians is to create an atmosphere of expectation. And when I say that, what I mean is we should expect one another to change. As Christians, we should expect each other to grow. That over time, there's this development of joy, Paul says, in our lives that ought to increase. One of my favorite Christian teachers says that the church should be a place where it's okay to not be okay. We come in here today and none of us are perfect. All of us are broken. So it's okay to not be okay. But it's not okay to stay that way. That we should grow, we should progress, we should develop in our spiritual lives, in our spiritual existence. And so as Paul talks to these Philippians, he says, hey, you should do that. You should change. Well, the question comes up, how do I do that? How do I grow? And what Paul says, the way we grow is heart transformation. Heart transformation. That's the way that you and I, that we grow. And he said this to all the churches that he works with in the New Testament, pretty much, maybe in different ways. To the Romans, he said that we should be transformed, same word there, by the renewing of your minds. To the Galatians, he said, I've worked with you, I strived with you until Christ was formed, same word, in you. To the Corinthians, he says, you are transformed into the same likeness from glory to glory, same word. So this idea of heart transformation kind of permeates everything that Paul writes. How does it work? Here's what Paul says. God is at work in you to will and to do according to his good pleasure. That's one side. The other side of that, he says, and you work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. So God is working in you on the inside, and you are working out what God is working in. So God's got a part. He's working in you, and you've got a part. You're working out what God is working in. Now, I want you to notice, nowhere in there does it say, and the pastor's job is this. Nowhere in there is that mentioned. your relationship with God, while I have the privilege of being your pastor and I get to encourage it and hopefully equip you, and our staff has the role of coming alongside you and helping you develop, your spiritual life can't be based on me or on our staff team or on any other pastor, priest, or spiritual leader, because ultimately we are flawed, broken people. We're all in the same boat. And if your Christianity depends on me, you're going to be sorely disappointed, because at some time, if you hang around here long enough, I'm going to disappoint you. One of our staff members is going to disappoint you. Your relationship with God is yours, and you've got to take ownership of it. So your part is working out. You say, well, okay, great. How do I do that? How do I work out this salvation? Here's how it works. It's the difference between exercise and effort. Difference between exercise and effort. One time when Angie and I were dating, we were watching one of the six greatest movies of all time together. Rocky 1, Rocky 2, Rocky 3, Rocky 4. You get the picture, right? We were watching Rocky 3, and it was the scene where Rocky was doing the exhibition match with Thunder Lips, who was played by Hulk Hogan. You remember that scene? And so he was the wrestler, Rocky was the boxer, and they were kind of doing this demonstration kind of thing for charity. Well, both of them were oiled up, and I mean, they're ripped and everything. And so we watched that for just, I don't know, 30, 45 seconds, and Angie looks over at me while we're watching it, and she says, you know what? I've never really been into, like, really, really big muscles. So I sat there and thought about that for a while. And I looked for the compliment underneath it, but I could never find it. I just kept digging and digging and digging. I couldn't find it. So I thought, well, maybe like running. Maybe running is the answer. And so I started, you know, trying to run a little bit. However, I know some of you here today, when we talk about running, you ran the Cap City Marathon, half marathon maybe, yesterday. If you would have come to me on Friday and said, hey, Dean, why don't you come and run Cap City Marathon with me? No matter how much effort I put into it, I couldn't do it because I haven't been exercising for it. You know, whenever you run a marathon or a half marathon, there's a training regimen you go through. You start running a couple days a week, and then you have the long run on the weekend. So if you're trying to run a marathon, maybe you start with 3 miles. Then the next weekend, you run 4 miles. The next weekend, 5 and 6 and 7. And you actually work your way up all the way up to like 18 to 20 miles, and then you're ready for the marathon, right? So you have to exercise or train your way into it. You can't just effort your way into a marathon. Let me choose something different, maybe a different metaphor. Music. I grew up in a really musical family. My mom was our church pianist for like 26 years. Both of my sisters are really, really pretty good singers. They sang together all the time. And I wanted to express my musical ability at a young age. And so I tried to play an instrument. I tried to play piano. Took piano lessons, made it for 6 months before I think my piano teacher kindly kicked me out. And she said, look, this is not your thing. Go find your thing. So I wanted to sing. So I actually sang 2 solos in church growing up. And all of the dogs in Southern Ohio came around barking whenever I sang my solos. So, you know, I actually gave that up because of my love for music. So whenever I tried that, what I learned was music is actually not something you do by effort. It takes a lot of work. Like, you have to do vocal scales and all that kind of stuff, because when you first start singing, there are notes that you can't hit without working through that process. So you can't effort your way into being necessarily a great musician. Doesn't matter how bad you want to do it, you've got to exercise your way into it. So here's what I'm saying. Doesn't matter whether it's a physical activity or a discipline like music. You train your way into that. You do the things you can do to eventually be able to do the things that you can't do. You run as much as you can today so that eventually you're able to run 26.2 miles. Or you play Every Good Boy Does Fine, right, on the piano so that eventually you can play a concerto piece. You do what you can do today so that you eventually are able to do what you can't do today. Heart transformation is exactly like that. See, what happens is we wrap our lives around things that we can do, things in our relationship with God that we can do that will help us grow in joy so that we can eventually do the things that we can't do maybe today. So like in the area of joy, we're going to consistently engage in, I'll throw one out for you, reading the Bible. And I know as soon as I say that, you're like, oh, reading the Bible. I tried to read the Bible, Dean, but the Bible, I don't understand it. It has big words. It's boring. I can't get past this chapter or this chapter. Listen, we don't read the Bible to learn something new. We don't read the Bible to certainly to be entertained. Paul says, and I mentioned the verse earlier, that we read the Bible to be transformed, how? By the renewing of your mind. And as you and I daily read the scriptures, what happens is that God washes our minds with his word, and it's kind of like pushing the reset button every day, that it kind of gives you a new foundation for the day. Now, eventually, from the exercise of reading scripture, over and over and over and over and over again, day after day after day after day, what happens is that in moments of adversity, we are able to face them more consistently and not live this kind of up and down life that's based on our circumstances, our happiness, or our comfort. Does that make sense? Now, if we don't eventually get into a rhythm or a pattern of doing that, we tend to default in Christianity to a different way of living. And the default for most of Christianity is that instead of heart transformation, we settle for behavior modification. And through our own effort, we just try and fix what we think is wrong with us through exterior pattern change alone. Paul talks about that here in this passage. Look at verse 14. He says, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish, in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world." So what Paul says here is that behavior modification is that thing that's gonna stunt or shorten our growth whenever it comes to joy. See, the Philippians had a problem. They not only had a problem with heart transformation, but they had a problem with complaining and whining and grumbling and questioning. And I don't mean you got a question, you ask your question. That's a great thing. They had an attitude of question. They questioned everything like they were the authority instead of God being the authority. And what Paul is trying to say to them is that this thing over here, heart transformation, is connected to this attitude of grumbling and complaining. How are they connected? Well, whenever all we do is behavior modification and try to adjust our behavior on the outside without engaging what God is doing on the inside of us, behavior modification is maddening. Because no matter how much effort we put into it, eventually we fail. And when we fail, we go through this cycle of shame and guilt, and we have to find a way to muster up the ability and the effort to start all over again and try new again. And here we come. And it's just this constant highs and lows. You get too high, you feel prideful, like you've conquered it and you're done. And then all of a sudden, you fall down here, back down to the bottom. And you see, behavior modification, it doesn't work. So behavior modification, things like whining and questioning, grumbling, complaining, they're not just bad habits. Paul says, I think from this passage, he's trying to point out that they're sins. And they're sins because God has designed us to have joy. We were created for joy. There's a guy named Frank Lake, who's a Christian psychologist slash thinker slash philosopher. And he was troubled one time with the reality that in the church that that he served in, lived in, was his family was part of, they constantly felt like he watched people who gave lots and lots of effort. And people really who were patted on the back a lot for everything they did. They would work and work and work and work, and all of a sudden they would just disappear. It's like they burnt out, like just flamed out. they served in this group and that committee and this team and this program. And then all of a sudden they were just gone. And other people filled their roles and came in behind them and started doing all that stuff. And it's like they just disappeared. And he wanted to figure out why that was. What was it that they were missing? Why did they not have that consistency of joy? Why did they feel like they had to give so much effort and work for it all the time? So he studied the life of Jesus. And Lake came up with what he called the rhythms of grace. And he found four rhythms of grace in the life of Jesus that he eventually kind of called the cycle. It's a cycle of grace. It's kind of sequential. And the first thing in the cycle is the idea of acceptance. That right from the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he heard his Father say, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." And that became the defining reality for Jesus. That he was okay, that he was God's Son. And really, outside of that, nothing else defined him. Nothing else hid his identity. He didn't live for attention. He didn't live for human approval. He didn't live for success. That the baseline for Jesus was the fact that he was accepted by his Heavenly Father. And that rolls right into number two, the idea of sustenance. That it wasn't just that Jesus heard that one time and then he kind of left that and went and worked really, really hard, but that daily he had this pattern, this rhythm of going back to his Father and allowing the fact that his Father had accepted him to sustain him. That's what really fueled his life. Well, the third rhythm, that kind of rolls right into this idea of significance. And among everything that Jesus did, and certainly his redemptive work on the cross, Lake said that as he studied Jesus' life, one of the things that he recognized is that Jesus poured an incredible amount of time to the people that he gathered around him. And not only did he replenish people, but the God of the universe in human form allowed people to replenish him. I want you to think about the magnitude of that for just a minute. Think about it from this perspective. Have you ever traveled or been made to travel with a group of people? About 2 months ago, I went somewhere, and I went somewhere with a group, big group of people. I hate traveling with a group of people. You know why? Because they slow me down. They got to go to the bathroom at all the wrong times. They're hungry at all the wrong times. They're thirsty at all the wrong times. They bring all this stuff with them that I don't think is necessary. You know, I remember thinking on that trip, if I was by myself, I could get this thing done a whole lot faster. If it was just me and it was me and I knew what I was doing. And I just don't like traveling with groups. Now think about Jesus. Think about all of the times that Jesus had to stop the mission of God and listen to Simon Peter whine and complain. Think about all the times that Jesus had to stop the process of the salvation of every human soul so that he could hear Thomas talk about his doubting one more time. Or think about all the times he had to stop the group and say, "Okay, I've already said this to you, but remember the leaven and the yeast and the dough. Let's go over this again, okay? One more time." I thought, how much more could Jesus have accomplished if he had just done it by himself? And I started trying to quantify it. Like, could he have done twice as much? Three times as much? Four times as much? Five times as much could Jesus have accomplished? If he had just done it by, why did he do this? Jesus allowed himself to be replenished by others and to spend time replenishing others because he was about the process of igniting a movement, of multiplying himself in the life of other people. So what does that tell me about you and me? We need other people. We need to replenish other people, and we need to allow people to replenish us. And listen, I get it. Some of us are extroverts and just, and some of us are more introverts. And maybe we don't need it as much, but we're created and designed. And if Jesus did it that way and he needed it, that means we need it. And you listen, I can already hear your arguments. Dean, there are certain people that I do not like. I get it. I get it. You can split the world up into two groups of people, right? There are some people who bring joy wherever they go. They light up a room. They encourage people. Some people bring joy wherever they go. And other people bring joy whenever they go, right? They just, you can't wait to see them go the other way. And I know everybody's personalities are different. And so there are some people who are going to build into you and replenish you that you're going to like. And there are other people who are going to bring a little friction. And I would just say to us, both are necessary. Both are important. You know, that's why what Troy said up here this morning about Life Group United this summer, I believe is so critical. It is not enough for us to say, man, I'm going to effort it all by myself. I'm going to put it on my shoulders and this whole life and joy thing. We can't do it alone. We cannot grow in joy the way at least we ought to grow in joy all by ourselves. You know, I put that list of things up there, the rhythms. The last one is achievement. And I could spend a lot of time talking about this. I don't have time to. But really, you know, Christianity really was the foundation of Western education. Christianity was the foundation of modern hospitals and missions. Christianity was the foundation of most of the art that we see in the Western world. All those kinds of things. So Jesus, through this movement he ignited, there's all kinds of achievement. But now look at that list for just a second. Does anything stand out to you about that list? Here's what jumps out at me about that list. We live those four rhythms exactly backwards from how Jesus lived them. We go out into the world and we say, okay, I've got to achieve some things, because if I achieve some things, that's what's going to make me a significant person. And when I become a significant person through a number of achievements, that's going to sustain my life. And when I have sustained significance from the things that I achieve, then other people are going to accept me and love me and want me to be part of whatever it is that they're part of, and I'm going to get attention for that. We live exactly the opposite of the way Jesus lived these four rhythms. And I'll just tell you, 1 to 4, starting out with acceptance, moving down to achievement, that's the cycle of grace. 4 to 1, that's nothing more than a cycle of works and human effort. 1 to 4, that is life. 4 to 1, that is death to us. We're just not capable of sustaining it. I'll give you an example. One of the early church fathers, we call him St. Augustine of Hippo. Hippo was the place he lived in Africa. In 386, Augustine was an older teenager, early 20s. And up to that point in his life, he was kind of a rebellious cultural guy. He was somewhat of a womanizer. He slept with lots and lots of women there, the big city that he lived in Africa, some through religious rituals and a lot just through the prostitution that existed there in the city of Hippo. But in 386, he traveled. He traveled up towards Asia, up towards Europe. And while he was gone, he became converted to Christianity, kind of radically converted to Christianity, and spent the rest of his time up there with Christians who kind of took time, poured into him. But eventually, he went back to Hippo in 387 A.D. And when he got back home, one night, he was walking through the streets. And as he was walking, one of his old flames, one of his old girlfriends, saw him. And she yelled out to him. She said, "Augustine, I'm so glad you're home. It's good to see you. Come and spend the night with me." And Augustine just kept walking. Didn't even acknowledge her. And she couldn't figure out what was wrong. So she runs ahead of him. And she stops right in front of him. Makes him stop. And says, "Augustine, don't you recognize me? It's me." And Augustine looks at her and says, "Yes, but it's no longer me." You see, what Augustine was saying is there's been a transformation that's taken place on the inside of me, such to the degree that I no longer need your arms, your embrace tonight. I'm different. And can I tell you, as believers, there ought to be some things in our lives that a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that would have tripped us up, that today we can look at and say, as much as tempting as it is, it's no longer me. I'm different. I'm changed. I mentioned traveling with a group. Part of that process is that I was going to a prayer summit in Wisconsin. And I think I've said to you before the impact that the book Experiencing God has had on my life a number of times, beginning in college, a number of times I've taken that course. And Henry Blackaby was one of the authors of that book, who typically gets the credit for writing Experiencing God. But that book was actually co-written. Henry Blackaby co-wrote it with Claude King. And King actually wrote more of the content. Blackaby told more of the stories, the illustrations of God's activity. And while I was at this prayer summit in Wisconsin, Claude King was there. And he stood up for about 15 minutes and spoke one day. And here's one of the things he talked about. He said, you know, after I wrote Experiencing God, right towards the end of the 80s and early 90s, he said, I started getting asked to come and speak places a lot. And he said, that put me on the road traveling. He said, I was traveling about 220, 230, 40, 50 days in a given year. And he said, one of the things that happened to me is after I would speak sometimes at night, I'd go back to my hotel room and I'd turn the TV on and I found myself flipping through the channels and I found myself lingering on channels that really I had no business watching. And he said, slowly over time, what I started to realize is that I could feel my joy, my Christian joy, just kind of fading. And he said, I was so frustrated that one night, in the middle of the 90s, he said, I got on my knees in my hotel room, and I said, God, if you will give me back my joy, I will never turn on another TV alone in my hotel room. And he said, over the next couple of days, the next couple of weeks, he kind of sensed that joy returning from his relationship with God. And he looked at us and he said this, and he said, men, he said, that was 19 years ago that I prayed that prayer in my hotel room. And in the last 19 years, I have never touched a TV alone in a hotel room. And I've never missed it. What is he saying there? Here's what he's saying. That the labor pains of saying no to a naked woman on a TV screen that he could never touch anyway is nothing compared to the infinite joy that is offered to him in his relationship with Christ. Think about it this way. Who would ever know whether or not Claude King turns on the TV when he's alone? Who would know? Who would know if he held on a channel to... Nobody. Who would know if that night Augustine had seen that gal and said, you know what? It's one night. Nobody's ever going to know. Why would they say no to things like that? Because the value of joy had become so great to them in terms of their heart transformation that there was a love that was stronger than these other loves in their lives. Here's what I think Augustine is saying, Claude King is saying, Paul is saying, Jesus is saying. I think they're all saying the same thing, that what matters most in this life is not what happens to you. What matters most in this life is what happens in you. And our great example in this, as always, is Jesus. You know, the book of Hebrews says about Jesus, it calls him the author and finisher of our faith. And then it says this, who for the joy, there's our word, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. So what was the joy of Jesus? Was the joy of Jesus to come to earth and go to the cross? No. It said he endured the cross. Was the joy of Jesus to take the sin of you and me and all of us in the world, to take our sin on his shoulders? No. It says that he despised, or he hated, the shame. What was the joy of Jesus? The joy of Jesus in the redemptive work that he did on the cross was to bring imperfect people like you and me, who were far away from God, back together with him. Jesus restored the fellowship that Adam and Eve had in the Garden of Eden that they broke. Jesus restored that. That's the gospel, so that we can come back to God and be one with him. That you and I are unbelievably flawed and broken, but at the same time, we are unbelievably loved through the cross. And it's that love that Paul says in the New Testament, for the love of Christ compels me. The love of Christ is my motivation for everything that I do. It's the baseline of joy in my heart and in my life. So if you're here today and you don't have a personal relationship with Christ, and you think, man, Christianity is all about a set of rules, and it's all about effort, and it's all about working really hard and behavior modification on the outside, just like I see everybody else do, you couldn't be any more wrong. It's about this reality that God wants to give you something way deeper. Something that is so real and tangible on the inside of you that you don't have to say no. You want to. Because the love of Christ compels you. See, the big what if journey in this series, the big what if the first week, what if death could become life? The things that weigh us down, things that we give effort to try and change. The answer to the big what if is that God is working in you. That what we talked about the second week, what if I could have my marriage back? You know, some of us get in patterns in our marriage and we just get stubborn. And what's amazing to me is that we'll come to church. Man, we'll worship, smile at everybody. But the reality is we're stubborn in patterns in our marriage, and we refuse to change. If you'll allow God to work in you, he can begin to change those patterns and give you joy that'll allow you to see beyond your current circumstances to see the eternal value of your marriage. If you're here today and you don't have a personal relationship with Christ, his joy is for you to understand principle number one in the cycle of grace, that you have been accepted by your heavenly Father. You can be called his son or his daughter. And that can happen today. Let's pray.